following is an Audio Renaissance presentation.
Hello, I'm Bill Hartley, president of Audio Renaissance. I'm very pleased to introduce you to this special two-cassette edition of Napoleon Hill's classic, Think and Grow Rich, co-produced by Audio Renaissance Tapes and Cassette Productions Unlimited. This unique presentation of Think and Grow Rich combines excerpts from the book read by Joe Slattery with personal anecdotes told by the author himself, Napoleon Hill. Because there's so much valuable information contained in every minute of this two-hour program, we've included a self-help success manual designed for you to use along with the audio cassettes. We hope that it'll assist you in organizing your study of Napoleon Hill's philosophy of success, and that it'll become a record of your personal growth as you think and grow rich. Just before we begin, I'd like to give you the following information from the publisher's preface. Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, published by Fawcett Crest, New York, copyright 1937 by Napoleon Hill. Revised edition, copyright 1960 by Combined Registry Company. Copyright under International and Pan-American Copyright Conventions. All rights reserved and transferred, January 1963, to Napoleon Hill Foundation, Charleston, South Carolina. And now, here's Joe Slattery with Napoleon Hill and our special presentation of Think and Grow Rich.
Think and Grow Rich is one of the most influential books of all time in pointing the way to personal achievement, to financial independence, and to riches of the spirit beyond measurement in money. There has never been another book like it, nor ever can be. It was inspired by Andrew Carnegie, who disclosed his formula of personal achievement to the author, Napoleon Hill, many years ago. Carnegie not only made himself a multimillionaire, but he made millionaires of more than a score of men to whom he taught his secret. Another 500 wealthy men revealed the source of their riches to Napoleon Hill, who has spent a lifetime of research in bringing their message to people in all walks of life who are willing to give their thoughts, ideas, and organized plans in return for riches. The riches within your grasp cannot always be measured in money. There are great riches in lasting friendships, harmonious family relationships, sympathy and understanding between business associates, an inner harmony which brings peace of mind measurable only in spiritual values. The philosophy of Think and Grow Rich will prepare you to attract and enjoy these higher estates which always have been and always will be denied to all except those who are ready for them.
Everyone desires to be rich, but not everyone knows what constitutes enduring riches. And most people believe riches to consist only in material things that money can buy. Now, here is a list of the 12 things which constitute real riches. Number one, a positive mental attitude. Observe that it heads the list. And second, sound physical health. And third, harmony in human relations. And fourth, freedom from fear. And fifth, the hope of future achievement. And sixth, the capacity for applied faith. And seven, willingness to share one's blessings with others. 8, to be engaged in a labor of love. 9, an open mind on all subjects toward all people. 10, complete self-discipline. 11, wisdom with which to understand people. And 12, financial security. Observe, if you will, with great benefit, the fact that money comes at the end of the list of the 12 things that make men rich.
Be prepared when you begin to put the philosophy of Think and Grow Rich into action for a changed life which will not only ease the trials and stresses of living, but will also prepare you for the accumulation of material riches in abundance. In every chapter of this book, mention has been made of the money-making secret which has made fortunes for hundreds of exceedingly wealthy men whom I have carefully analyzed over a long period of years. If you are ready to put it to use, you will recognize this secret at least once in every chapter. I wish I might feel privileged to tell you how you will know if you are ready, but that would deprive you of much of the benefit you will receive when you make the discovery in your own way. As a final word of preparation, before you begin the first chapter, may I offer one brief suggestion which may provide a clue by which the Carnegie secret may be recognized. It is this: all achievement, all earned riches, have their beginning in an idea. If you are ready for the secret, you already possess one half of it. Therefore, you will readily recognize the other half the moment it reaches your mind. When you begin to think and grow rich, you will observe that riches begin with a state of mind, with definiteness of purpose, with little or no hard work. You and every other person ought to be interested in knowing how to acquire that state of mind which will attract riches. I spent 25 years in research because I too wanted to know how wealthy men became that way.
My brother and I had matriculated at Georgetown University Law School intending to become lawyers. We didn't have any money, but I did have ability to write, and I promised that I would write stories about successful men, sell them to a magazine, and pay our way through. And my first assignment, fortunately, was with Andrew Carnegie in Pittsburgh. He gave me 3 hours. And when the 3 hours were over, he said, "Now, this interview is just beginning. Come on out the house, stay all night, and after dinner we'll pick up the interview again." He kept me there 3 days and nights. And believe you me, I was more than flattered. I wondered what it was all about. He kept talking to me about the need for a new philosophy. He said, "We've had many philosophies, the days of Socrates and Plato, on down to the days of William James and Emerson, but most of them dealt with the moral laws of life. What we need is an economic philosophy for the man of the streets that will enable him to make use of the know-how gained by men like myself over a lifetime of experience." Well, it sounded very nice to me, except for one thing. I didn't know exactly what that word philosophy meant. And finally, at the end of the third day, he said, "Now look here, I have been talking to you for 3 days about the need for a new philosophy, and I'm going to ask you a question about it. If I commission you to become the author of this philosophy, give you letters of introduction to men whose experiences you will need in collaboration with yourself, are you willing to put in 20 years of research, because that's how long it will take, paying your own way as you go along without any subsidy from me, yes or no?" Now, ladies and gentlemen, there have been many times in my life when I have faced difficult problems and difficult decisions. I don't think I ever faced one more embarrassing than that. Because when Mr. Carnegie put that proposition to me, my hand was down in my pocket, and I was fiddling with the money that I had there, just about enough to get back to Washington. And if I'd had to stay at a hotel instead of Mr. Carnegie's house, I wouldn't have had that much. I didn't even know the meaning of the word philosophy. And here, the richest man in the world wanted me to go to work for him for 20 years without pay. Wasn't that a situation for you? I started to tell Mr. Carnegie, I started to do just exactly what you or the most of us people would have done under the same circumstances. And what do you think that was? What would you have done if you would have faced that sort of proposition, going to work for 20 years without any pay for the richest man in the world? Well, yes, that's what I was about to do. But something inside of me wouldn't let me open my mouth until I got a hunch that if Mr. Carnegie had kept me there for 3 days, it must have been for a purpose. That he must have seen something in me that I didn't know was there. Also, that a man with Mr. Carnegie's reputation for picking men certainly didn't pick me to do a job like that unless he knew I had the ability to do it. And whatever this something was, this silent, invisible person that was standing, looking over my shoulder and whispering into my ear, said, "Go ahead and tell him yes." I said, "Mr. Carnegie, I not only will accept the commission, sir, but you may depend upon it that I will complete it." He said, "I like the way you ended that sentence up, and I think you'll do it. You have the job." The only contribution Mr. Carnegie ever made to me outside of introducing me where I need to be introduced was to pay my expenses in the early part of my relationship with him. The first man he sent me to see was Henry Ford. Now, he said, "I want you to go up to Detroit, become acquainted with Henry Ford, observe him carefully, because one of these days he's going to dominate the motor industry." And it's going to be second only to the steel industry. This was in 1908, the late fall of 1908, ladies and gentlemen. I went up there and spent 2 days trying to find Ford, and when I did find him, he came out of the rear of a shop where he'd been doing some experimenting with an old pair of overalls on, a plug hat or a derby hat that had been bashed in the crown, grease all over his hands. I remember he got my shirt sleeves dirty when I shook hands with him. And I sat down for a half hour with Mr. Ford, and about all of his conversation consisted of yes and no, mostly no. And I wondered how a man like Mr. Carnegie could have made a mistake like that. Imagine if Mr. Ford would ever be a leader in anything. Well, I won't tell you the rest of it. That's enough.
Desire. The starting point of all achievement. The first step toward riches. A long while ago, a great warrior faced a situation which made it necessary for him to make a decision which ensured his success on the battlefield. He was about to send his armies against a powerful foe, whose men outnumbered his own. He loaded his soldiers into boats, sailed to the enemy's country, unloaded soldiers and equipment, then gave the order to burn the ships that had carried them. Addressing his men before the first battle, he said, "You see the boats going up in smoke. That means that we cannot leave these shores alive unless we win. We now have no choice. We win or we perish." They won. Every person who wins in an undertaking must be willing to burn his ships and cut all sources of retreat. Only by so doing can one be sure of maintaining that state of mind known as a burning desire to win, essential to success. Every human being who reaches the age of understanding of the purpose of money wishes for it. Wishing will not bring riches, but desiring riches with a state of mind that becomes an obsession, then planning definite ways and means to acquire riches, and backing those plans with persistence which does not recognize failure, will bring riches. 6 ways to turn desires into gold. The method by which desire for riches can be transmuted into its financial equivalent consists of 6 definite practical steps. That is, first, fix in your mind the exact amount of money you desire. It is not sufficient merely to say, "I want plenty of money." Be definite as to the amount. There is a psychological reason for definiteness, which will be described in a subsequent chapter. Second, determine exactly what you intend to give in return for the money you desire. There is no such reality as something for nothing. Third, establish a definite date when you intend to possess the money you desire. Fourth, create a definite plan for carrying out your desire and begin at once, whether you are ready or not, to put this plan into action. Fifth, write out a clear, concise statement of the amount of money you intend to acquire, name the time limit for its acquisition, state what you intend to give in return for the money, and describe clearly the plan through which you intend to accumulate it. Sixth, read your written statement aloud twice daily, once just before retiring at night and once after arising in the morning. As you read, see and feel and believe yourself already in possession of the money. It is important that you follow the instructions described in these 6 steps. It is especially important that you observe and follow the instructions in the 6th paragraph. You may complain that it's impossible for you to see yourself in possession of money before you actually have it. Here is where a burning desire will come to your aid. If you truly desire money so keenly that your desire is an obsession, you will have no difficulty in convincing yourself that you will acquire it. The object is to want money and to become so determined to have it that you convince yourself you will have it. Can you imagine yourself a millionaire? To the uninitiated, who has not been schooled in the working principles of the human mind, these instructions may appear impractical. It may be helpful to all who fail to recognize the soundness of the 6 steps to know that the information they convey was received from Andrew Carnegie, who began as an ordinary laborer in the steel mills, but managed, despite his humble beginning, to make these principles yield him a fortune of considerably more than $100 million. It may be a further help to know that the six steps here recommended were carefully scrutinized by the late Thomas A. Edison, who placed his stamp of approval upon them as being not only the steps essential for the accumulation of money, but for the attainment of any goal. No hard labor. They call for no sacrifice. They do not require one to become ridiculous or credulous. To apply them calls for no great amount of education. But the successful application of these six steps does call for sufficient imagination to enable one to see and to understand that accumulation of money cannot be left to chance, good fortune, and luck. One must realize that all who have accumulated great fortunes first did a certain amount of dreaming, hoping, wishing, desiring, and planning before they acquired money. You may as well know right here that you can never have riches in great quantity unless you can work yourself into a white heat of desire for money and actually believe you will possess it. If the thing you wish to do is right and you believe in it, go ahead and do it. Put your dream across, and never mind what they say if you meet with temporary defeat, for they, perhaps, do not know that every failure brings with it the seed of an equivalent success. Thomas Edison dreamed of a lamp that could be operated by electricity, began where he stood to put his dream into action, and despite more than 10,000 failures, he stood by that dream until he had made it a physical reality. Practical dreamers do not quit.
Imagine a man, for instance, standing by through 10,000 different failures, as Mr. Edison did, before giving up. His personal initiative was so definite that he told me that if he hadn't found the secret of the incandescent electric lamp, that at that very moment he would be in the laboratory working on it instead of being out there wasting his time talking with me. And then in a more serious note, Mr. Edison said, I had to succeed, because I finally ran out of things that wouldn't work. And I've thought of that so many times, wondering why more people don't keep on keeping on until they run out of things that won't work, for then they're bound to find the thing that will work.
There is a difference between wishing for a thing and being ready to receive it. No one is ready for a thing until he believes he can acquire it. The state of mind must be belief, not mere hope or wish. Open-mindedness is essential for belief. Closed minds do not inspire faith, courage, and belief. Remember, no more effort is required to aim high in life, to demand abundance and prosperity, than is required to accept misery and poverty. I believe in the power of desire backed by faith, because I have seen this power lift men from lowly beginnings to places of power and wealth. I have seen it rob the grave of its victims. I have seen it serve as the medium by which men staged a comeback after having been defeated in 100 different ways. I have seen it provide my own son with a normal, happy, successful life, despite nature's having sent him into the world without ears.
When my second son Blair was born, he was born without ears. And the doctors told me that he would be a deaf mute all of his life. I told them he would not be a deaf mute, and that he would live to have 100% of his hearing just like other children. And one of these doctors came over and put his arm on my shoulder, and he said, "Now look here, Napoleon, there are some things in this world that neither you nor I nor anyone else can do anything about, and now you face one of those situations." I said, "Doctor, there is nothing in this world that I can't do something about, if it's nothing more than adjust myself to an unpleasant situation so it does not destroy my spirit." I went to work on that child through prayer before I ever saw him. I worked on him continuously, almost 4 hours a day for the first 4 years of his life. And at the age of about 18 months, we recognized that he was beginning to hear. We didn't know just how much. But by the time he had reached the fourth year, he had developed 65% of his normal hearing. And in his third year in college, in the University of West Virginia, the Acoustican Company, manufacturer of hearing aids, heard about this unusual case, the only one of its kind in the world where a child born without ears ever learned to hear. Came down to the University of West Virginia and made him a special hearing aid that gave him the other 35% of his hearing, and Blair today has 100% of his hearing just exactly like I said he would. almost one of the modern miracles of medical science, that this thing happened. And the doctors today don't know exactly how it did happen. I'm not so sure that I did, but I know what I was doing to help bring it about.
Faith is the head chemist of the mind. When faith is blended with thought, the subconscious mind instantly picks up the vibration, translates it into its spiritual equivalent, and transmits it to infinite intelligence, as in the case of prayer. The emotions of faith, love, and sex are the most powerful of all the major positive emotions. When the three are blended, they have the effect of coloring thought in such a way that it instantly reaches the subconscious mind, where it is changed into its spiritual equivalent, the only form that induces a response from infinite intelligence. How to develop faith? There comes now a statement which will give a better understanding of the importance the principle of autosuggestion assumes in the transmutation of desire into its physical or monetary equivalent. Namely, faith is a state of mind which may be induced or created by affirmation or repeated instructions to the subconscious mind through the principle of autosuggestion. Repetition of affirmation of orders to your subconscious mind is the only known method of voluntary development of the emotion of faith. No one is doomed to bad luck. There are millions of people who believe themselves doomed to poverty and failure because of some strange force over which they believe they have no control. They are the creators of their own misfortunes because of this negative belief, which is picked up by the subconscious mind and translated into its physical equivalent. In language which any normal human being can understand, we will describe all that is known about the principle through which faith may be developed where it does not already exist. Have faith in yourself, faith in the infinite. Before we begin, you should be reminded again that faith is the eternal elixir which gives life, power, and action to the impulse of thought. The foregoing sentence is worth reading a second time, and a third, and a fourth. It is worth reading aloud. Faith is the starting point of all accumulation of riches. Faith is the basis of all miracles and all mysteries which cannot be analyzed by the rules of science. Faith is the only known antidote for failure. Faith is the element, the chemical, which, when mixed with prayer, gives one direct communication with infinite intelligence. Faith is the element which transforms the ordinary vibration of thought created by the finite mind of man into the spiritual equivalent. Faith is the only agency through which the cosmic force of infinite intelligence can be harnessed and used by man. Thoughts which are mixed with any of the feelings of emotions constitute a magnetic force which attracts other similar or related thoughts. Now let us go back to the starting point and become informed as to how the original seed of an idea, plan, or purpose may be planted in the mind. The information is easily conveyed. Any idea, plan, or purpose may be placed in the mind through repetition of thought. This is why you are asked to write out a statement of your major purpose or definite chief aim, commit it to memory, and repeat it in audible words day after day until these vibrations of sound have reached your subconscious mind. Resolve to throw off the influences of any unfortunate environment and to build your own life to order. Taking inventory of mental assets and liabilities, you may discover that your greatest weakness is lack of self-confidence. This handicap can be surmounted and timidity translated into courage through the aid of the principle of autosuggestion. The application of this principle may be made through a simple arrangement of positive thought impulses stated in writing, memorized, and repeated until they become a part of the working equipment of the subconscious faculty of your mind. Self-confidence formula. First, I know that I have the ability to achieve the object of my definite purpose in life. Therefore, I demand of myself persistent, continuous action toward its attainment, and I here and now promise to render such action. Second, I realize the dominating thoughts of my mind will eventually reproduce themselves in outward physical action and gradually transform themselves into physical reality. Therefore, I will concentrate my thoughts for 30 minutes daily upon the task of thinking of the person I intend to become, thereby creating in my mind a clear mental picture. Third, I know through the principle of auto-suggestion, any desire that I persistently hold in my mind will eventually seek expression through some practical means of attaining the object back of it. Therefore, I will devote 10 minutes daily to demanding of myself the development of self-confidence. Fourth, I have clearly written down a description of my definite chief aim in life, and I will never stop trying until I shall have developed sufficient self-confidence for its attainment. Fifth, I fully realize that no wealth or position can long endure unless built upon truth and justice. Therefore, I will engage in no transaction which does not benefit all whom it affects. I will succeed by attracting to myself the forces I wish to use and the cooperation of other people. I will induce others to serve me because of my willingness to serve others. I will eliminate hatred, envy, jealousy, selfishness, and cynicism by developing love for all humanity, because I know that a negative attitude toward others can never bring me success. I will cause others to believe in me because I will believe in them and in myself. I will sign my name to this formula, commit it to memory, and repeat it aloud once a day with full faith that it will gradually influence my thoughts and actions so that I will become a self-reliant and successful person. The disaster of negative thinking. The subconscious mind makes no distinction between constructive and destructive thought impulses. It works with the material we feed it, through our thought impulses. The subconscious mind will translate into reality a thought driven by fear just as readily as it will translate into reality a thought driven by courage or faith. Like the wind which carries one ship east and another west, the law of auto-suggestion will lift you up or pull you down, according to the way you set your sails of thought. Auto-suggestion, the medium for influencing the subconscious mind, the third step toward riches. Auto-suggestion is a term which applies to all suggestions and all self-administered stimuli which reach one's mind through the five senses. Stated in another way, auto-suggestion is self-suggestion. It is the agency of communication between that part of the mind where conscious thought takes place and that which serves as the seat of action for the subconscious mind. See and feel money in your hands. You were instructed in the last of the six steps described in the chapter on desire to read aloud twice daily the written statement of your desire for money and to see and feel yourself in possession of the money. By following these instructions, you communicate the object of your desire directly to your subconscious mind in a spirit of absolute faith. Through repetition of this procedure, you voluntarily create thought habits which are favorable to your efforts to transmute desire into its monetary equivalent. Remember, therefore, when reading aloud the statement of your desire, through which you are endeavoring to develop a money consciousness, that the mere reading of the words is of no consequence unless you mix emotion or feeling with your words. Your subconscious mind recognizes and acts only upon thoughts which have been well mixed with emotion or feeling. Plain, unemotional words do not influence the subconscious mind. You will get no appreciable results until you learn to reach your subconscious mind with thoughts or spoken words which have been well emotionalized with belief. Do not become discouraged if you cannot control and direct your emotions the first time you try to do so. Remember, there is no such possibility as something for nothing. You cannot cheat, even if you desire to do so. The price of ability to influence your subconscious mind is everlasting persistence in applying the principles described here. You cannot develop the desired ability for a lower price. You, and you alone, must decide whether or not the reward for which you are striving, the money consciousness, is worth the price you must pay for it in effort. Your ability to use the principle of auto-suggestion will depend very largely upon your capacity to concentrate upon a given desire until that desire becomes a burning obsession.
Please fast forward to the end and turn the tape over for proper cueing of side two.
Six steps to stimulate your subconscious mind. The instructions given in connection with the six steps in the second chapter will now be summarized and blended with the principles covered by this chapter as follows. First, go into some quiet spot, preferably in bed at night, where you will not be disturbed or interrupted. Close your eyes and repeat aloud, so you may hear your own words, the written statement of the amount of money you intend to accumulate, the time limit for its accumulation, and a description of the service or merchandise you intend to give in return for the money. As you carry out these instructions, see yourself already in possession of the money. For example, suppose that you intend to accumulate $50,000 by the 1st of January, 5 years hence, that you intend to give personal services in return for the money in the capacity of a salesman. Your written statement of your purpose should be similar to the following. By the first day of January 19 so-and-so, I will have in my possession $50,000, which will come to me in various amounts from time to time during the interim. In return for this money, I will give the most efficient service of which I am capable, rendering the fullest possible quantity and the best possible quality of service in the capacity of salesman of, and here describe the service or merchandise you intend to sell. I believe that I will have this money in my possession. My faith is so strong that I can now see this money before my eyes. I can touch it with my hands. It is now awaiting transfer to me at the time and in the proportion that I deliver the service I intend to render in return for it. I am awaiting a plan by which to accumulate this money, and I will follow that plan when it is received. Second, repeat this program night and morning until you can see in your imagination the money you intend to accumulate. Third, place a written copy of your statement where you can see it night and morning, and read it just before retiring and upon arising until it has been memorized. Remember, as you carry out these instructions, that you are applying the principle of auto-suggestion for the purpose of giving orders to your subconscious mind. Remember also that your subconscious mind will act only upon instructions which are emotionalized and handed over to it with feeling. Faith is the strongest and most productive of the emotions. Follow the instructions given in the chapter on faith. These instructions may at first seem abstract. Do not let this disturb you. Follow the instructions, no matter how abstract or impractical they may at first appear to be. The time will soon come, if you do as you've been instructed, in spirit as well as in act, when a whole new universe of power will unfold to you. Specialized knowledge, personal experiences or observations, the fourth step toward riches. There are two kinds of knowledge. One is general, the other is specialized. General knowledge, no matter how great in quantity or variety it may be, is of but little use in the accumulation of money. The faculties of the great universities possess in the aggregate practically every form of general knowledge known to civilization. Most of the professors have but little money. They specialize on teaching knowledge, but they do not specialize on the organization or the use of knowledge. Knowledge will not attract money unless it is organized and intelligently directed through practical plans of action to the definite end of accumulation of money. Lack of understanding of this fact has been the source of confusion to millions of people who falsely believe that knowledge is power. It is nothing of the sort. knowledge is only potential power. It becomes power only when and if it is organized into definite plans of action and directed to a definite end. This missing link in all systems of education may be found in the failure of educational institutions to teach their students how to organize and use knowledge after they acquire it. Many people make the mistake of assuming that because Henry Ford had but little schooling, he was not a man of education. Those who make this mistake do not understand the real meaning of the word educate. That word is derived from the Latin word educo, meaning to educe, to draw out, to develop from within. An educated man is not necessarily one which has an abundance of general or specialized knowledge. An educated man is one who has so developed the faculties of his mind that he may acquire anything he wants or its equivalent without violating the rights of others.
You must remember that Mr. Edison only had 3 months of schooling in his entire life, although he chose a work that called for the application of many of the sciences. He knew nothing about any of them. Now, you may wish to ask, how in the world did he get along with only 3 months of schooling in the business of inventing, dealing with the sciences, and yet knowing nothing about any of them? I've been asked that question many times. Well, the answer is very simple. He got along by surrounding himself with men who did understand the sciences, technical men, educated men, and he used their brains just as successfully as if he had had the knowledge himself. As a matter of fact, every successful man in the upper brackets of achievement makes use of other people's knowledge and their influence and their education under the mastermind principle. Then there would be Mr. Andrew Carnegie, my sponsor. He came over to this country in the steerage, didn't have enough money to pay first-class fare on the boat. And he rose to a high position in the world by surrounding himself with men who knew more than he did, who could do the things that he wanted done. And I could name 100 others who started in low positions and rose to high positions in life by associating themselves with other people under the mastermind principle.
The accumulation of great fortunes calls for power, and power is acquired through highly organized and intelligently directed specialized knowledge. But that knowledge does not necessarily have to be in the possession of the man who accumulates the fortune. The preceding paragraph should give hope and encouragement to the man with ambition to accumulate a fortune who has not possessed himself of the necessary education to supply such specialized knowledge as he may require. Men sometimes go through life suffering from inferiority complexes because they are not men of education. The man who can organize and direct a mastermind group of men who possess knowledge useful in the accumulation of money is just as much a man of education as any man in the group. Back of all ideas is specialized knowledge. Unfortunately, for those who do not find riches in abundance, specialized knowledge is more abundant and more easily acquired than ideas. Because of this very truth, there is a universal demand and an ever-increasing opportunity for the person capable of helping men and women to sell their personal services advantageously. Capability means imagination, the one quality needed to combine specialized knowledge with ideas in the form of organized plans designed to yield riches. If you have imagination, this chapter may present you with an idea sufficient to serve as the beginning of the riches you desire. Remember, the idea is the main thing. Specialized knowledge may be found just around the corner. Any corner. Imagination. The workshop of the mind. The fifth step toward riches. The imagination is literally the workshop wherein are fashioned all plans created by man. The impulse, the desire, is given shape, form, and action through the aid of the imaginative faculty of the mind. Two forms of imagination. The imaginative faculty functions in two forms. One is known as synthetic imagination, and the other as creative imagination. Synthetic imagination. Through this faculty, one may arrange old concepts, ideas, or plans into new combinations. This faculty creates nothing. It merely works with the material of experience, education, and observation with which it is fed. It is the faculty used most by the inventor, with the exception of the genius who draws upon the creative imagination when he cannot solve his problem through synthetic imagination. Creative imagination. Through the faculty of creative imagination, the finite mind of man has direct communication with infinite intelligence. It is the faculty through which hunches and inspirations are received. It is by this faculty that all basic or new ideas are handed over to man. It is through this faculty that one individual may tune in or communicate with the subconscious minds of other men. Center your attention for the time being on the development of the synthetic imagination, because this is the faculty which you will use more often in the process of converting desire into money. Transformation of the intangible impulse of desire into the tangible reality of money calls for the use of a plan or plans. These plans must be formed with the aid of the imagination, and mainly with the synthetic faculty. The laws that lead to fortune. The earth on which you live, you yourself, and every other material thing, are the result of evolutionary change through which microscopic bits of matter have been organized and arranged in an orderly fashion. Moreover, and this statement is of stupendous importance, this earth, every one of the billions of individual cells of your body, and every atom of matter, began as an intangible form of energy. Desire is thought impulse. Thought impulses are forms of energy. When you begin with a thought impulse, desire to accumulate money, you are drafting into your service the same stuff that nature used in creating this earth and every material form in the universe, including the body and brain in which the thought impulses function. If you are one of those who believe that hard work and honesty alone will bring riches, perish the thought. It is not true. Riches, when they come in huge quantities, are never the result of hard work alone. Riches come, if they come at all, in response to definite demands based upon the application of definite principles and not by chance or luck. Generally speaking, an idea is an impulse of thought that impels action by an appeal to the imagination. All master salesmen know that ideas can be sold where merchandise cannot. Ordinary salesmen do not know this. That is why they are ordinary.
There was Clarence Saunders, one of my outstanding students of Memphis, Tennessee. Clarence worked in a grocery store, delivering groceries, more or less. And he had a great amount of enthusiasm and also a keen imagination. He was constantly trying to interest his employer in new and improved methods of merchandising. And finally, the employer became so peeved at Clarence for wasting his time with what he called foolish suggestions that he told him that if he came in with another one, he was going to fire him. Shortly thereafter, a cafeteria was opened in Memphis, Tennessee, the first cafeteria that came there. And when Clarence went out to his lunch that day, he saw a great line of people out extending out onto the sidewalk, waiting to be served in the cafeteria. Out of curiosity, he got on the end of the line, and when he picked up his tray and filled it up, by the time he got down to the cashier or the checker, his imagination began to turn, and he said, what a wonderful thing this would be in our grocery business, to have a self-help grocery store so women could come in with a basket on their arm, pick up what they wanted, and pay for it at one place as they went out. It would save a lot of time, and it would save a lot of embarrassment. Well, Clarence could hardly wait until he got back to the store, and he rushed in and he said, well, boss, I have a multi-million-dollar idea, and the boss said, now, Clarence, you're fired. Clarence said, oh, no, I'm not. I resigned before I started to talk. Later on, I talked to the man who was Clarence's boss, and he said as near as he could figure, every word that he used in trying to fire Clarence had cost him $1 million. Because Clarence took his idea of self-help grocery stores to a firm who financed it under the name of Piggly Wiggly Stores, and he made $4 million during the first 4 years. An astounding illustration of what a man can do with an idea backed by the proper amount of enthusiasm.
Organized planning. The crystallization of desire into action. The sixth step toward riches. You have learned that everything man creates or acquires begins in the form of desire. That desire is taken on the first lap of its journey from the abstract to the concrete into the workshop of the imagination, where plans for its transition are created and organized. You will now be instructed how to build plans which will be practical. Namely, A. Ally yourself with a group of as many people as you may need for the creation and carrying out of your plan or plans for the accumulation of money, making use of the mastermind principle described in a later chapter. Compliance with this instruction is absolutely essential. Do not neglect it. B. Before forming your mastermind alliance, decide what advantages and benefits you may offer the individual members of your group in return for their cooperation. No one will work indefinitely without some form of compensation. No intelligent person will either request or expect another to work without adequate compensation, although this may not always be in the form of money. C. Arrange to meet with the members of your mastermind group at least twice a week, and more often if possible, until you have jointly perfected the necessary plan or plans for the accumulation of money. D. Maintain perfect harmony between yourself and every member of your mastermind group. If you fail to carry out this instruction to the letter, you may expect to meet with failure. The mastermind principle cannot obtain where perfect harmony does not prevail. Keep in mind these facts. First, you are engaged in an undertaking of major importance to you. To be sure of success, you must have plans which are faultless. Second, you must have the advantage of the experience, education, native ability, and imagination of other minds. This is in harmony with the methods followed by every person who has accumulated a great fortune. The most intelligent man living cannot succeed in accumulating money, nor in any other undertaking, without plans which are practical and workable. Just keep this fact in mind, and remember when your plans fail, that temporary defeat is not permanent failure. It may only mean that your plans have not been sound. Build other plans. Start all over again. No follower of this philosophy can reasonably expect to accumulate a fortune without experiencing temporary defeat. When defeat comes, accept it as a signal that your plans are not sound. Rebuild those plans and set sail once more toward your coveted goal. If you give up before your goal has been reached, you are a quitter. A quitter never wins, and a winner never quits. Lift this sentence out, write it on a piece of paper in letters an inch high, and place it where you will see it every night before you go to sleep and every morning before you go to work.
Take my son Blair, for instance, who was born without any sign of ears. As a result of that adversity, he was trained to believe that it was not an adversity, that it was a blessing, because it would cause people to recognize his condition and they'd go out of their way to be kind to him. And that's exactly the way it turned out. I have often said that my son Blair has made it possible to get through life with less resistance than his other two brothers who have all of their faculties. Adversity. I think I can tell you, had it not been for the many adversities which I experienced in the early part of my work with Andrew Carnegie, I never would have completed the Science of Personal Achievement. I had adversity after adversity, but I learned to transmute those adversities into something constructive and to come up with something that would take the place of an adversity. Every time I failed, I said, well, this is just another opportunity that I have to prove that my philosophy can take care of the situation of failure. I learned to transmute all failures into successes. I also learned the difference between temporary defeat and failure. Most people accept defeat as permanent failure. Defeat is never failure. No circumstance is ever failure until it is accepted by the individual as such. And that's one of the greatest things that I learned about this principle of profiting by adversity.
When you begin to select members for your mastermind group, endeavor to select those who do not take defeat seriously. Some people foolishly believe that only money can make money. This is not true. Desire, transmuted into its monetary equivalent through the principles laid down here, is the agency through which money is made. Money of itself is nothing but inert matter. It cannot move, think, or talk, but it can hear when a man who desires it calls it to come. Planning the sale of personal services. Intelligent planning is essential for success in any undertaking designed to accumulate riches. Here will be found detailed instructions to those who must begin the accumulation of riches by selling personal services. It should be encouraging to know that practically all the great fortunes began in the form of compensation for personal services or from the sale of ideas. What else except ideas and personal services would one not possessed of property have to give in return for riches? The major attributes of leadership. The following are important factors of leadership. 1. Unwavering courage based upon knowledge of self and of one's occupation. No follower wishes to be dominated by a leader who lacks self-confidence and courage. No intelligent follower will be dominated by such a leader very long. 2. Self-control. The man who cannot control himself can never control others. Self-control sets a mighty example for one's followers, which the more intelligent will emulate. 3. A keen sense of justice. Without a sense of fairness and justice, no leader can command and retain the respect of his followers. 4. Definiteness of decision. The man who wavers in his decisions shows that he is not sure of himself, cannot lead others successfully. 5. Definiteness of plans. The successful leader must plan his work and work his plan. A leader who moves by guesswork without practical, definite plans is comparable to a ship without a rudder. Sooner or later, he will land on the rocks. 6. The habit of doing more than paid for. One of the penalties of leadership is the necessity of willingness upon the part of the leader to do more than he requires of his followers. 7. A pleasing personality. No slovenly, careless person can become a successful leader. Leadership calls for respect. Followers will not respect a leader who does not grade high on all of the factors of a pleasing personality. 8. Sympathy and understanding. The successful leader must be in sympathy with his followers. Moreover, he must understand them and their problems. 9. Mastery of detail. Successful leadership calls for mastery of the details of the leader's position. 10. Willingness to assume full responsibility. The successful leader must be willing to assume responsibility for the mistakes and the shortcomings of his followers. If he tries to shift this responsibility, he will not remain the leader. If one of his followers makes a mistake and shows himself incompetent, the leader must consider that it is he who failed. 11. Cooperation. The successful leader must understand and apply the principles of cooperative effort and be able to induce his followers to do the same. Leadership calls for power, and power calls for cooperation. How to get the exact position you desire? Everyone enjoys doing the kind of work for which he is best suited. An artist loves to work with paints, a craftsman with his hands, a writer loves to write. Those with less definite talents have their preferences for certain fields of business and industry. If America does anything well, it offers a full range of occupations, tilling the soil, manufacturing, marketing, and the professions. First, decide exactly what kind of job you want. If the job doesn't already exist, perhaps you can create it. Second, choose the company or individual for whom you wish to work. Third, study your prospective employer as to policies, personnel, chances of advancement. Fourth, by analysis of yourself and your talents and capabilities, figure what you can offer and plan ways and means of giving advantages, services, developments, ideas that you believe you can successfully deliver. Fifth, forget about a job. Forget whether or not there is an opening. Forget the usual routine of, "Have you got a job for me?" Concentrate on what you can give. Sixth, once you have your plan in mind, arrange with an experienced writer to put it on paper in neat form and in full detail. Seventh, present it to the proper person with authority, and he will do the rest. Every company is looking for men who can give something of value, whether it be ideas, services, or connections. Every company has room for the man who has a definite plan of action, which is to the advantage of that company. This line of procedure may take a few days or weeks of extra time. But the difference in income, in advancement, and in gaining recognition will save years of hard work at small pay. It has many advantages, the main one being that it will often save from 1 to 5 years of time in reaching a chosen goal. Every person who starts or gets in halfway up the ladder does so by deliberate and careful planning.
For instance, back in the early days when I wanted to get a job from a certain firm while I was going to high school, here's the way I went about it. I wrote an application stating my qualifications and my desire for the job. The answer came back, no, too sorry, no position open. Next, I sent a telegram. Answer was still no. And next, I sent a special delivery letter every day for a week. Answer was still no. Next, I sent a special delivery every hour for 2 days. And the firm telegraphed me to come and go to work.
Every person must be his own salesman of personal services. The quality and the quantity of service rendered, and the spirit in which it is rendered, determine to a large extent the price and the duration of employment. To market personal services effectively, which means a permanent market at a satisfactory price under pleasant conditions, one must adopt and follow the QQS formula, which means that quality plus quantity plus the proper spirit of cooperation equals perfect salesmanship of service. Remember the QQS formula, but do more. Apply it as a habit. Let us analyze the formula to make sure we understand exactly what it means. 1. Quality of service shall be construed to mean the performance of every detail in connection with your position in the most efficient manner possible, with the object of greater efficiency always in mind. 2. Quantity of service shall be understood to mean the habit of rendering all the service of which you are capable at all times with the purpose of increasing the amount of service rendered as greater skill is developed through practice and experience. Emphasis is again placed on the word habit. 3. Spirit of service shall be construed to mean the habit of agreeable, harmonious conduct which will induce cooperation from associates and fellow employees.
Well, let me relate my experience with Franklin D. Roosevelt in the White House in 1933, and we'll give you a fine indication of how the students of this philosophy may profit by this important principle. First of all, let me define the principle of going the extra mile. It means rendering more service and better service than you are paid to render, and doing it all the time, and doing it in a pleasing, positive mental attitude. When I went to work for the president in 1933, nothing was said at the beginning about how much I was to receive or who was to pay it. And I had been there about 3 months when one day Franklin D. Roosevelt asked me who was paying my salary and how much I was getting. And I said, well, Mr. President, that's something I would like to know myself. I haven't heard anything about it. And we talked on for a little while, and I said, well, now, Mr. President, you know, I have been serving you ever since you were Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and particularly while you were Governor of New York. And you will recall, of course, that up to this time I have never rendered you a bill or asked you to pay me a dollar for my services, and I'm not going to start now. But if you insist upon it, suppose you put me on the payroll at a dollar a year. And that's exactly what he did. Well, I took my typewriter down to the White House, and when I wasn't actually serving the president or some member of his staff or cabinet, I started writing books. I wrote 6 books that first year, among them Think and Grow Rich, the book that has made me popular all over the world, you might say. I had no intention of publishing that book when I was writing it. I was writing it to myself to keep my mind positive in those days of chaos. Well, some 3 years after I left the service of the president, I got out these manuscripts and read them, and I made up my mind that the only one worth publishing was Think and Grow Rich. And when I took it to my publisher, he said, well, what is in this book that leads you to believe it would sell? I said, you will have to read it to find out. He took it home with him and read it. He had his whole staff read it paragraph by paragraph, and then they took a vote on it, and they voted unanimously that it was the best manuscript that ever came to that publishing house. They printed it, put it to work, and it's been selling as a best seller all over the world up to this time. It has grossed over $18 million and probably will gross many more millions of dollars while I'm still alive. It's been translated into many languages. It was endorsed by Mahatma Gandhi and distributed widely throughout India. It went from there to Brazil, where it was translated into the Portuguese language and is widely distributed throughout Latin America. And I think if you will stop and consider the wages that I asked, the wages that I received of $1 a year, and the service that I gave for that, you'll recognize what can be accomplished by going the extra mile. Now, let me give you some of the benefits that comes from going the extra mile. Well, it places the law of increasing returns squarely back of one. It brings one to the favorable attention of those who can and do provide opportunities for self-promotion. It tends to permit one to become indispensable in many different human relationships, and therefore enables one to command more than average compensation. It leads to a mental growth and physical perfection in various forms of service, thereby developing greater ability and skill in one's chosen vocation. It protects one against the loss of employment and places one in a position to choose his own job and working conditions. It enables one to profit by the law of contrast because the majority of people do not practice the habit of going the extra mile. As a matter of fact, the majority of people don't even go the first mile. And it leads to the development of a positive, pleasing personal attitude, which is among the more important traits of a pleasing personality. And it tends to develop a keen, alert imagination, as it is a habit which keeps one continuously seeking new and more efficient ways of rendering service. It definitely serves to develop self-reliance. It serves also to build the confidence of others in one's integrity. And it is the only logical reason to justify one in asking for a promotion or for more wages, because if a man is not doing any more than he's paid for, then obviously he has no right to ask for more pay.